The following podcast contains explicit language.
Hello, and welcome to the Up in the Air edition of Slate Money, your guide to the business and finance news of the week. I'm Felix Salmon of Fusion. I'm joined here in Slate's Brooklyn offices by the regular crew, Kathy O'Neill, the author of Weapons of Mass Destruction.
Hello.
And Jordan Weissman, the Slate pitchiest money box columnist ever.
Hello, y'all.
And Jordan wrote a piece this week, which we're going to talk about in a minute, which was all about airline travel. So we're going to have a kind of air-themed episode this week. We're going to talk about how it turns out to be quite hard for software companies like Google or even Amazon to put physical objects into the air and have them not crash. It's rather a fun story. We are going to talk about Air Force One, which is a slightly antiquated thing which needs to be replaced, but how and whether and how much it'll cost is in the news. But first, Jordan, the one thing we all are obsessing about as the holiday travel season approaches is, are we going to get charged to carry on bags as we enter an airplane?
Starting in 2017, I think we might. This holiday season, we might be safe. But so the news is that United has figured out yet another way to slap an irritating fee on its customers, even though that's what they claim that's not what they're doing. It's what they're doing. They have debuted a new fare tier called Economy Basic, right?
Which is basically Ryanair arrives in America.
Yeah, well, sort of, because Ryanair is dirt cheap, whereas what Economy Basic is your standard fare, basically, except you don't get to put your bag in the overhead bin. You're not allowed to do that. And you can't get an assigned seat.
No assigned seats. You're almost guaranteed a middle seat.
Yeah, you're guaranteed. They even said, like, you are getting a middle seat, essentially, if you buy this ticket. And you get something the size of a small satchel, a backpack that you can put under the seat in front of you still. You're entitled to that. You are allowed to bring some sort of belongings on the plane.
If you do check a bag, you have to pay for it.
If you do have to pay for it, exactly.
And they didn't mention it explicitly, but you're also not allowed to breathe the entire flight. You have to hold your breath.
So,
because if you breathed out and then tried to breathe in again, you'd find that there's not enough space for your neighbors.
So I wrote a piece about this week, and it made two points. One is that I think no matter what your feelings in general about price discrimination are and, you know, kind of unbundling, I think you are allowed to be outraged about this, especially if this spreads to the other major airlines. And number two, I think this is actually tracks perfectly with what Republicans are trying to do to Americans' healthcare system. And okay, so we're going to discuss this.
No, we are not.
We're
going
to discuss both of these things.
We are not going to discuss Republican healthcare. I want to keep this a little bit on the up in the air. Because frankly, if you want to know what the connection is to Republicans and healthcare, go to Slate.com, read Jordan's piece, and you can roll your eyes as loudly as you like.
I think it's a great analogy.
Okay,
actually,
maybe we'll get to the analogy. But okay, let's start with the price discrimination. It's interesting that this is coming from United, because I don't know if you guys remember. I feel like I'm the only person who remembers this. But a few years ago, United decided, you know, this was back when JetBlue was popular and profitable airline, that they were going to attempt something similar themselves. And they created this airline called TED, which was like the second half of United. We're not going to call it Uni, we're going to call it TED. And it lasted about 6 weeks, I think. But they're back on this idea of, like, how do we make money by selling cheaper tickets rather than just buy more expensive tickets. And rather than creating a new airline this time, they've just said, well, there's a whole bunch of really crappy experiences that we can foist onto the people who pay the least amount of money. So let's do that.
Yeah. I mean, listen, I looked into this and I actually feel like I've missed out on a lot of things that were happening in the airline industry, maybe because I had kids and didn't fly that often. But I didn't realize that you can't, nobody feeds you for free anymore. Like, yeah. I didn't even know that.
Oh, absolutely not. I'm an idiot. That's been a while. Yeah.
I mean, every now and then I get on an air flight and I'm like, wow, I'm so hungry and I just don't know why. And then, of course, there's the baggage. If you want to check baggage, that's been a fee for a long time. So they're looking for new ways.
Even the lounges, even if you go into like the airline lounges on for domestic flights, they will make you pay for your drink. Yeah. Which kind of defeats the whole purpose of being in an airline lounge.
So there's two reasons for this, I think. And the first is that they're just much more efficient with airline flights than they used to be. It used to be that like you probably never had to sit in a middle seat because there were so many empty seats.
That
right?
was called something called capacity control.
And we got better at that.
No, well, yeah, capacity control is another word for antitrust collusion.
Yeah.
Which is basically, it's basically all of the airlines colluding with each other to have slightly fewer seats on any given route than there is demand for, so that they can fill up all of the flights and make the maximum amount of profit.
Yeah. I mean, so the massive consolidation in the industry is kind of taken from one extreme to the other, right? Before, you had airlines constantly going bankrupt because they couldn't make money. Now they've consolidated down to just a few carriers. And so they can kind of collude without explicitly colluding, just follow each other's trail and just do things like, you know, control the number of seats in the air.
And also keep prices high when
fuel costs
when
are very
fuel,
low.
When fuel costs were rising, when oil was very expensive, prices would go up every week. They'd be like, oh, we have to raise prices because the price of gasoline has gone up, or air fuel. And then when the price of air fuel plunged, guess what? The prices stayed high.
And the other sort of, I think, major reason, tell me if you disagree, that this has happened is that everyone buys their own flights on Expedia or what have you. And they don't think about anything. They don't care about brand. They don't think about anything except the price they're seeing on the screen, and they minimize that.
Yes. And that's become a consumer, that's become a consumer issue, because a lot of watchdogs are saying, okay, you are essentially hiding the real cost of your flight by advertising these incredibly cheap basic fares. And I think that is a big part of it.
And this is something which has been endemic to the rental car industry for forever, that you're saying, oh my God, I can rent that car for $7.99 a day. And then you get in there and you realize with all the extras, it turns out to be $77 a day.
Exactly.
Like, how did that happen?
So there is an economic rationale for this. And I'm going to explain it quickly and then explain why I think it's bullshit in this case.
And then I'm going to say why I love this idea.
Okay. So here's the thing. There is this idea of price discrimination that individual customers shouldn't have to pay for services they're not going to use. Instead, if you are only going to, show up with one light bag that you can throw under your seat, you should pay for a ticket that only covers the cost of, transporting you through the air in a metal bird with that one light bag. And if you're going to show up with a huge, four suitcases or whatever, and you need to check those, then you should pay for that because you personally are adding cost to the flight by making it heavier and making them take up more fuel. Okay, so it's more consumer choice, and that makes it possible for people who might ordinarily not be able to afford to fly if everyone was sharing these costs together to get on a plane. That's the economic rationale for this sort of thing. However, my thing that pisses me off is when you get to the point where you're saying you have to essentially pay for any bag you want to bring on the plane or any, significant piece of luggage, that means that anybody who's older, who has kids, who is, injured, is essentially going to be paying extra because there's no way they're going to be able to carry all their stuff in a little, tiny backpack. And so that's what bothers me, is this is really charging families and sick people more money. And that's how I got into the Republican healthcare.
The slogan from the greatest film ever made with Nell and I is free to those who can afford it, very expensive for those who can't. And it's basically the people who are wandering, who are sauntering. I like this idea of sauntering. The people who are sauntering onto a plane with nothing but a briefcase are precisely the people who can afford the expensive tickets. And the people who have all of the baggage and the kids and everything are the people who can't.
Okay. And now I'm going to make the argument for this. Okay. And the argument for this, and I agree with everything you just said.
Okay. But
the argument for this is that it is especially in the age of like the paid for the check-in luggage, it is insane when you get to the gate how many people have these sort of maximally sized like roll-on baggage that they're all trying to get first onto the plane, and then everyone pays like or signs up for membership or something like that so that they can be one of the people that gets on first.
It's what's known as a suboptimal equilibrium.
I am that guy with the giant bag.
Oh my God. I know you are.
So let me explain what happened here, because it's fascinating, is that a few years ago, the airline started charging for checked baggage, and they did this as a way of making extra fee income, which was good for them because they made more money. But they did it wrong, and they allowed carry-ons to remain free, and they started charging $25 or however much it is per bag for the checked bags. And so that gave everyone this incentive to stuff as much as they could into a carry-on and to not check bags. What they should have done is make the carry-ons an extra $25 fee and then make check bags free. And that would have solved the problem. And I believe Spirit Airlines does that, and it makes much more sense.
It makes much more sense for the passengers who want to just walk onto the plane. It's impossible to walk onto the plane. And 75% of people are somehow pre-boarding. And it's crazy, right? On the other hand,
it also created the race to get onto the plane first.
Yes.
Like, when I was first traveling on airplanes, I always was the guy saying, I want to get onto this plane last because I don't want to be stuck on that airplane for a minute longer than I have to be. Now everyone wants to get onto the plane first because it's the only way you can find space to put your bag.
Yeah, exactly. I'm the person who checks in, by the way.
But so I can understand if they were, or I would be less outraged if they were going the route of, okay, you are checking, you're paying to have a carry-on, and you are not paying to check your bag. Like, if that were what was happening, I would not be as infuriated as I currently am. But that's not. They're just charging for everything.
Well, they have this, I mean, there is this tier, right, which is a bit more expensive, called, like, economy, as in not basic economy,
yeah,
which is a bit more expensive, and that means that you're paying, the difference between basic economy and economy is the amount that you're paying to be able to bring a bag on for free.
Yeah, but the basic, I mean, the hustle here is that their basic economy tier is really not going to cost much less, if anything less, than their current regular economy tickets.
But the regular economy tickets is going to be basic economy plus whatever, $50, and that $50 is going to be the amount that you're paying to bring a bag onto the
plane.
I just want to add one more layer on this, or maybe one and a half, which is that I thought about this a lot when I was flying on my book tour, and then I realized that nobody actually cares about the passengers, right? They, as far as the airlines are concerned, we're doing them the free work of stowing our own bags, right? If they let us check these things for free, they'd have to pay people to load that stuff and unload it. So they're making us do the work, and it actually totally makes sense, even in terms of time, because if you think about what the bottleneck for flying is, it's not the time spent like fighting with your fellow passengers to get a space. It's actually the runway. The runway is the time, is the bottleneck. So they're perfectly happy to like let us fight for an hour and a half in order to like load up a plane to complete capacity and then wait for another hour and a half to get off the runway.
The thing which the airlines have become incredibly good at is pricing the things that we value but never used to pay for.
Yeah.
So the extra legroom in the exit row, or the early boarding, or the aisle seat, or the hot nuts, or whatever it was that you like.
I've never had hot nuts myself.
On an airplane? You've never joined the hot nuts club.
But it's now everything has a dollar value attached to it. And it's really interesting. Even, you know, it's interesting to see where those dollar values can wind up. And on East Coast to West Coast flight, the marginal extra cost of an exit row, you know, can be $300 or something. People, you're like, oh, wow. You know, that used to be luck of the draw. And now it's something they're auctioning off, and they're making real money doing it.
The last thing I want to say about this is that every time I'm on a totally crammed flight and I'm hating myself in my life, I think to myself, at least we're not like wasting extra jet fuel having empty flights anymore. We are saving the world. not really, because we're still flying, but yeah.
The carbon footprint of flying is probably lower than it would be if you were driving the same distance. Okay.
Apple Card is the perfect cash back rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
So talking of pricing air flight, there's the most famous airplane in the world, Air Force One, is this top secret, amazing flying command center. But it's showing its age, and there's talk about replacing it at some point, and this will take a long time. It'll take like 10 years. And so the process is just beginning, and Boeing is involved in that process. The current Air Force One is a very customized Boeing aircraft. And what happened this week, but the president-elect threw a massive spanner into the works by coming out with this tweet saying, this is ridiculous. Air Force One is far too expensive. It's going to cost $4 billion, and I'm going to get on the blower with Boeing and get them to
just cancel the order. Cancel the order.
This is like, you know, negotiating strategy. Like, cancel the order, and then if they want it, they're going to have to really cut their price.
It sounds so much more reasonable when you say it than when Trump tweets it. Sorry.
Is it? I don't know if it does.
I don't know if it does.
Sorry, I'm already near tears just thinking about this. Let's continue.
So Jordan, why is this a bad or silly thing for the president-elect to do? I mean, didn't Barack Obama cancel the Marine One order when he came into office?
Yes. Okay, so number one, I would like to stipulate that I am not an expert on the exact cost of building a flying fortress like Air Force One. I do not know all the details of exactly where they might be able to shave off a few dollars from building a thing that, you know, building a plane that can survive a nuclear blast.
Whoa, is that really true?
Yeah, that's literally what it's designed to do. It's like if there is a nuke attack, somehow the plane is going to keep flying. It can survive an EMP blast and stay up in the air. So I do not know exactly how much it costs to build this miracle of modern aviation and national security technology. The $4 billion cost is two of them. However, one thing to keep in mind is that Trump tweeted this like minutes after Boeing's CEO had gotten on the air and criticized him on his trade stance. So some of this is just pure vindictive, or it looks an awful like pure vindictiveness.
Actually, I mean, much more than some, because the $4 billion number that, as far as I can make out, only exists in a single Trump tweet, was just pulled out of thin air. Boeing responded saying, like, we've never said that anything was going to cost $4 billion. We have a $170 million contract to basically determine the scope of what this new plane should look like, and that's as far as it goes.
I've seen some numbers saying that realistically they're looking at $3 billion for actually producing these two planes. But yes, I mean, it's not even set yet. So there's that element of it, that this contract is still sort of like a protean thing. They're still figuring out exactly what they're going to do with it. But
that's a good Leo Carey word, that one.
Yeah.
Protean. So, I feel like people should use the word protean much more
often.
Sorry,
I try to keep it to monosyllables as much as possible on this show, I slipped there. But I mean, there's that aspect of it. And then there's just the element here that Trump is once again trying to kind of muscle the government's contract process for political advantage, which is a little bit worrisome if you're worried about things like, you know, kleptocracy spreading in the United States.
Well, I mean, before we get to kleptocracy, isn't it true that Trump himself has a bunch of, you know, airplanes and helicopters? Is he like trying to get the business? Is he like actually going to direct the business here? So I mean, that's my first guess.
No, I think he has like an old 747 with his name on it.
His jet is famous in private aviation circles for being particularly old and clunky and what's the word? Like not really fit for use. It's most people with private jets like private jets because of the convenience they afford. Trump travels around in a whopping great big and rather antiquated 747. And 747s are not in the slightest bit convenient because the number of airports you can land them in is tiny. So wherever you want to go, you probably can't go there in a 747. And so almost no one with a private jet would have such a thing. But Trump just picks the most ostentatious thing he can.
Its advantage, its only advantage is that it's big and he can paint his name in large gold lettering across. I mean, that is literally
so
the utility.
So he was looking at smaller airplanes, but he was like, the letters wouldn't be large enough.
Exactly.
So I don't know how he got this plane. Because also there was like the whole Trump Air thing. And there might be some convoluted story behind how he got his jet. But
the reality is that you're right, that the Trump administration is all about playing favorites. So he really likes hanging out with, you know, some sexist fast food CEO, and that person becomes the new Secretary of Labor. He really likes hanging out with that woman from the wrestling company, and then she becomes the head of the Small Business Administration. He doesn't like what the CEO of Boeing says, so he's like going to start saying mean things about Boeing and sending its share price down. He does like what the CEO of ExxonMobil says, so he starts talking about making him Secretary of State. I'm not making this up. It's like it becomes a very Russian form of capitalism, where basically the closer you are to the president and the nicer you are to the president, the more goodies get dropped on you.
So I had a really dispiriting conversation right after the Carrier incident, right? And there was this whole talk about how the Carrier deal where he saved some factory jobs was actually all about government contracts. The Carrier is owned by United Technologies, and United Technologies did not want to lose its big defense contracts or not be up for them in the future. And I had this theory that, in fact, there wasn't so much of a danger of a Trump administration using that lever to bully companies, because government contracting is a very formal, very complicated legal process where if you lose a bid, you are allowed to bring a challenge and you can haul the government into court and say, no, you did this incorrectly. There was all this malfeasance involved. And so,
not to mention like the process for like opening it up to bids,
exactly,
is like has to have some kind of amount of PR. Like people have to know about them and they have
100%. And so I had this whole idea in my head that, you know, there are some institutional checks here. And to verify that idea, I went and called up a very well-known government contracts lawyer who I can't name. It was a background conversation just to say, you know, am I right here? Am I crazy? And we had some real talk. And basically he was saying, you know, there are a lot of reasons I advise my clients not to piss off the government, because in fact, if they kind of cover their tracks in the right way and they say the right things and send signals a little bit subtly, you can kind of, there's sometimes not much a company can do if they lose out for political reasons.
Yeah, I feel like that's the first thing that Donald Trump would be excellent at, would be being incredibly subtle and covering his tracks.
Well, that's a question.
Well, the question really is, can Trump or his
minions,
cronies,
blacklist
a bunch of companies?
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. It's like there are subtle ways that you can't like draw up a blacklist, because if that makes it into court, you're in trouble. But there are ways that the message can be sent that this company might not be, you know, favored, you know, and that if it's all sort of winks and nudges and makes its way down the chain of command, it can be a threat. It's not out of the realm of possibility that companies will be nudged out of the market.
And this is clearly what Trump wants. He has never expressed any interest in a level corporate playing field where everyone competes equally. He's always wanted to say, you know, I want to intervene, I want to play favorites, I want to do deals, I want to start naming, you know, individual private citizens on Twitter and getting my Twitter army to go after them. He loves that power that presidents have always had but have never used because they've risen above it.
Well, realistically, though, I mean, how many alternatives to Boeing are there?
There are
for Air Force One.
No, I mean, there are. There's Airbus, which is a European company. So you can't have Air Force One be built by, you know, a Euro.
I can't company. Wait for the new Air Force One to be built by Bombardier. That would be awesome.
I mean, exactly.
Hello, I'm Imi Harper. On the Slow Newscast from Tortoise, I tell the story of how a Hong Kong billionaire was silenced.
I got bombs thrown into my house. I got people came here, ransacked my computer. And I got people fracturing me. I got this and that, but I'm safe.
And what it reveals about the freedoms Hong Kong no longer enjoys. Listen to Hong Kong's Rebel Billionaire on the Slow Newscast, wherever you get your podcasts.
Okay, Kathy.
Yes.
So it's hard to build a whopping great big flying fortress. It can't be that hard to build a drone, right?
Well, it's true that like every Christmas for the past 5 years, my three sons and husband have all asked for drones for Christmas. That's what we do.
And have they received them?
We've had many a drone in our living room tearing apart the Christmas tree.
My favorite one is the one which is in the shape of the Millennium Falcon.
Oh my God, I haven't seen that one.
Yeah, that's pretty good.
I'm totally buying that after we finish here. Usually they have like four helicopter like rotors or whatever mm-hmm. they're called. And they... one of them stalls and everything falls apart. So they're very, very fragile. And they tend to lose their battery very quickly. That's a big problem for drones. And that's exactly what has been going on for Google, who's been trying very hard since 2012 to set up a drone delivery system with not much luck. They've gone through three different leaders, to an MIT professor, an aerospace engineer from New Zealand, and many, many broken down drones. Very sad.
And Amazon's been trying the same thing, right? With not much greater success.
Yeah, well, we're not sure exactly where Amazon is, but yeah, they announced it in 2013, probably had it happening before then. They've been trying to deliver things in Cambridge, UK, and in the US. We're not really sure where they are. There's also a startup called Flirty that last month started delivering Domino's pizza via drone in New Zealand. And by the way, like, am I saying New Zealand a lot? And also, like, Google's like first successful drone drop was in Australia. This is like not a coincidence.
I mean, yeah, it's countries where it's all sheep.
With, like literally nobody can get hurt.
Yeah,
this is actually, there's a reasonably large internet industry in New Zealand because it is famous as being the country where if you want to try something out, that's where you try it. Because if it all goes horribly wrong, no one cares.
Yeah. Well, and here's the thing, that there was a really good Wall Street Journal article, which we should link to, that was sort of describing all the debacles that have gone that have happened for Google. The issue of like helicopters, which hover, versus like winged drones, which are good at gliding and they keep their battery life longer. But then how do you actually deliver something on an airplane without just throwing it at somebody?
And my favorite issue, which apparently went on for months and months, was the long debate about does it land or not?
Yeah. No, so they actually, exactly. The helicopters are good at landing. Airplanes are not. Once you get to the target for your drone drop, do you just drop it or do you actually land the drone? Or if you do land the drone, people might steal the drone or step on it or do something evil to it.
The dog could get it.
So their idea was like lower it with a string. But then do you have to have the person who's accepting it there at the time that you lower it?
Like, so the whole idea of drone delivery is it makes things more convenient, but there's just like nothing more convenient. There was a whole talk about, well, because we can't really tell the difference between a front yard and a swimming pool, what you need to do is put out a whole like welcome mat with a QR code on it, and
that's
we'll
right.
land it on. And you're like, this is not more convenient than just having the delivery guy leave a box on my doorstep.
Well, if you think about it, I mean, to give them a little credit, like, it's actually really inconvenient to get mail delivered, but we've had the system in place for so long to get mail delivered that we don't think of it as an inconvenience. This is part of our lives.
Well, so explain the inconvenience of getting mail delivered, because I have to say I don't find it that inconvenient.
Oh, it's very, well, if you live in New York City, it's pretty inconvenient. If you live in an apartment building, like,
which I do.
Okay. Well, how does your mail get delivered, Felix?
A person, a human being, comes to my building and puts the mail into my mailbox.
Okay, well, I don't have a mailbox.
What do you have?
I have just like a front door.
Okay.
So we have like a doorman, but who only works between 5 and 8 or, you know, midnight or something. So it is actually kind of a pain to get mail delivered to my house.
That's...
And I think a lot of people have that problem where they don't have just a doorstep that they can literally drop things off of. Anyway, my point is we have a system in place for mail, and we'd have to develop a new system for drone mail, which may or may not be actually more bulky than our current system. But right now, we don't have it, so it seems very bulky.
So there's, like, the big picture issue here that this brings up is the question of whether or not tech companies like Google can move on from the digital world to actually making real things, right? Like, can they design drones? Can they do a self-driving car? Or can they, you know, build an internet of things, stuff for your house? And they're turning out not to be so great at that so far.
So here's the thing, you guys might not be surprised to hear me say this, but
yeah.
I don't think they're that great at algorithms either. So like the article, and this is not the only article, there are many articles that are saying Google isn't so good at non-algorithm stuff, huh? You know, and the way they say it is like, think about atoms, not just bits. And, you know, in this, I'm gonna, if you don't mind, I'm going to read this one line from the Wall Street Journal article. For the first time, tech firms are crafting devices that could hurt people. No. This is not the first time. It's just that it's much more obvious when a drone, and this example they give in this article, a drone sliced the eyeball of a toddler. Yes, that is obvious.
Yeah, that's suboptimal.
That is really, and if the drone crashes, it's an obvious mistake. But I guess my feeling is like we have actually had lots of sort of externalities, if you will, like destruction that is hard to measure that's happened because of algorithms. That's why I wrote my book. And now we're having obvious problems with physical kind of innovations.
And I think this is going to be a sort of running theme on Slate Money, because the move from the digital world into the physical world is fraught with difficulty. And what it does do, I think, Kathy, you're absolutely right, is it helps in a kind of retronymy kind of way to make us understand just how many difficulties we have been living with already in the software world but haven't quite been able to see. Farhad Manjoo at the Times had a great column this week about how, like, there aren't any gadgets anymore. That we used to live in a world of cool gadgets, and every year there was a new cool gadget. And when was the last time there was a new cool gadget? You know, there was that like brief craze of hoverboards, and then they all blew up in flames.
It's
and
the
then
truth.
And then the brief craze of hoverboards like ended.
I'm still looking for hoverboards, by the way.
But like, it's true. Like, gadgets are hard. Internet of Things is hard. I just moved into a new apartment, and I was so full of excitement about making it all super automated and sexy, and oh my god, it's hard.
Yeah. Kathy, I do want to push back on your point a little bit, which is, I think the difference between the problems they have with algorithms and the problems they have with their, you know, falling drones, is that with the algorithms, they do accomplish their main purpose. Like, they do help you search pretty well, you know, things like that. They do help match ads with your search results. Whereas the problems they're having with, you know, real world building their little flying devices is that it crashes. It doesn't do the main thing it is supposed to do. And
I'm so glad you came up with this pushback, because I'm going to push back to your pushback.
Okay.
Did you know that if you search for who won the popular vote in the United States election, the number one answer was Trump?
Wait, really?
Yes.
Okay.
Did you know that if you wrote "are Jews" and left it to autocomplete, it said evil, and then if you click that, 9 out of 10 results were explanations for why Jews are evil.
Okay, well, I saw this that, but I think that was a fair question. I would like someone to answer no to it, so I want people to be able to search.
My point
I will
is
say
that
the results are not so
they're,
great.
If their goal is to connect us to good information, then they are failing in that goal. And we have trouble measuring the extent to which that is damaging us. It's not easy to quantify a loss of knowledge. Right?
Yeah.
It is easy to quantify broken drones. That's all I'm trying to say.
Okay, I can see that.
I believe that Peter Thiel summed this all up with his slogan, right? Which is, they promised us flying cars and we got 140 characters.
Yeah.
Do you ever feel like there's nothing new in the news? You know there are urgent things happening in the world around you, but all you hear is noise. That's why we made What Next. Our goal is to tell you the stories you haven't heard before. Or maybe a different side to the story you thought you already knew all about. I'm Mary Harris, the host of What Next. And I love my job because it helps me cut through the noise of the news. And then I get to bring it to you. Together, we can figure out what next.
But we should have a numbers round.
Yeah, we should.
And I'm going to start the numbers round because my number is particularly stupid.
Good, good. I'm going for stupid, like escapism today. We're up in the air, baby.
I'm going to apologize ahead of time. Also, Up in the Air was an incredibly depressing movie, so I think mine is going to be in keeping with that.
It was Felix, kind of hollow, wasn't it?
Yeah. Anyway, go, Felix.
So my number is 85, which is the number of dollars that Nordstrom is charging for, I'm going to say this exact, what it's called, medium leather-wrapped stone.
What?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my God. Shane tweeted this, didn't Shane?
Yeah. So it was actually Catherine Rampell, I think, was the person who first found it. It is a 3-inch by 4.5-inch by 2-inch Los Angeles area stone, a stone from the Los Angeles area. And
it comes in a leather pouch.
It says here, each piece is unique and will vary slightly because no two stones are exactly the same. And then around this stone, about half of the stone is covered in leather. It's in a little leather pouch.
So it's a paperweight.
Well, according to this, it can be a paperweight. It can be a conversation piece, or it could be a work of art. It's up to you.
Wait, Felix, how big is the stone that I'm holding?
He gave us the exact measurements.
3-inch by 4.5-inch by 2-inch.
Sorry, How did you miss that?
I don't know. It's not even a big
it's
stone.
Very exciting.
This is the medium stone. There's a small stone.
By the way, that's not as expensive as like self-tying sneakers I mentioned last week.
No, it's not. But I feel like the thing which really distresses me about this is that there is a medium stone and there is a small stone, but there is no large stone. I mean, I want someone to go to that big Michael Heitzer stone outside LACMA and like wrap that thing in leather and charge
$1 million. It was in the super secret menu. I have two numbers, but I'm going to do the dumber one.
All right.
Let's keep things stupid.
Okay. 1,000. That's the number of Russian athletes that have been implicated now in cheating.
In doping.
Yeah. Great. Between 2011 and 2015.
That was one of the great technological breakthroughs of the past few years, actually, was the way that Russia managed to find a way to tamper with the tamper-proof lids on the urine sample cups in such a way that they could replace the tainted urine with clean urine, and it looked like they hadn't tampered with the lids.
They didn't do it well, though.
No, they did. No one ever noticed. They only got caught because the guy who was in charge of tampering with the tamper-proof lids finally came clean and admitted what he'd been doing.
Amazing. So, it's always the human that fucks up the plan.
I want to, since my number's going to be sad, I just want to add a slightly stupid riff to this number, which is, there was a kid in my high school, and he was notorious for trying to cheat on tests. And he semi-successfully did it regularly, but never that, not well enough that he had a really high GPA. It was like, I think he managed a B minus in the end. But, and we always just used to say, if this guy spent as much energy actually doing the work as he did creatively cheating, he would be such better shape. And I feel like that's just Russia, period. Like, that's like, if Russia spent less energy like hacking other people's elections and destabilizing foreign governments and cheating on the Olympics and like focused on just like sound macroeconomic policy, like maybe they'd be in slightly better shape. Anyway, that is my stupid riff before I get into my sad number.
What's your number?
My sad number is 50%, which is the percentage of millennials who, or basically 80s babies who are likely to make more, or who are making more money than their parents at the same age. There was a big new paper that came out basically showing that fraction has been in decline. The American dream is dying. Absolute mobility is dying. Previous generations could basically count on always making more money than their parents.
Unless, it was like 92% in the 1940s.
Unless you were at the very top 1%, unless you were born to very, very rich parents, relatively speaking, you could almost certainly count on making more than your family did before. And that is gradually, not quickly, fading.
And I feel like I don't love this statistic because, you know, in the 1970s, which is, you know, when it was 92%, when you're, you know, if you're a 30-year-old in the early 70s and you're saying, am I making more money than my parents did when they were my age? Well, my parents at my age were like fighting World War II when they were my age.
Yes, that is true. But I think,
and then there was the Korean War. Like, it's a lot easier to do better than your parents if your parents weren't doing very well at your age.
This is true. But it does speak to, I think, you know, our sense of prospects and horizons and why so many people are frustrated, because even if maybe, you know, absolute mobility was easier back in the day, it still sucks knowing that your standard of living is going to be worse than your parents' standard was and what you grew up with and became used to. And that, I think, feeds the sense of frustration. And it's also, I think it's angering to parents who see their children floundering. And it's also, there's one other aspect to this number, which is these same researchers did a paper a few years ago showing that what we call relative mobility, basically like where, you know, do you move up and down the income ladder? Like, you know, do you make it to the 1%? Hadn't really gotten any worse over the years, like that hadn't really changed. What we're seeing instead is this change in absolute mobility, whether or not you do better than your parents. So we're learning, it used to be that the American dream, maybe it's not really dying. It was always just kind of like a myth. Now we know precisely how it's dying. So that's
okay. We were meant to have a nice jolly riff about, you know, check baggage, and Jordan Weissman, as
I started with my high school classmate for a reason, anyway,
decides to drag it all down into like the death of the American dream. So on which
I still didn't even get to share my healthcare riff, for the love of God. Anyway,
so on which note, I will urge you to go to slate.com if you really want to read the reasons why checked bags are like purchase of provider organizations or whatever. I don't. You can do that, but before you do that, do subscribe to Slate Money if you don't already, and We are going to be having a live show on Thursday, this coming Thursday, December the 15th. The tickets are sold out unless you manage to find Lenny DeFranco has two tickets which he bought and which he is willing to sell you. If you can find Lenny, maybe you'll be able to get in. Otherwise, you will be able to listen to that show when it airs probably around New Year's. And that's going to be fun. We are going to have a regular episode next week.
Hungover, I might add.
We're going to have a hungover. We're going to have, like, yeah, the hungover episode next week. But for the time being, all I can do is thank Zach Dinerstein, the producer of the show, and the executive producers, Steve Lichtai and Andy Bowers. Check out all of Panoply's podcasts at itunes.com/Panoply. And we will talk to you next week on Slate Money.